Mondays. I'm your host, Chris Thierfelder. Today, we're talking about risk. Yes, that exciting topic that everyone wants to pretend only happens to other people. I want you to forgive yourself for being bad at assessing it, think differently about how you evaluate it, and understand why respecting risk in your project will help you respect it in your enterprise. You ready? Some risky business coming at you, pants optional. Let's go. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks so much for joining me again. Thank you so much for letting me into your brains, your lives, your cars, wherever you're listening to this. I know that we're trying something different and experimental this season, and I'm just really grateful that you have stuck around and have let me try to do something a little different that I do have a lot of passion around and really find super valuable. So I was reading an article in Fortune just the other day, within maybe a day or two of you even listening to this. And the article was actually about ChatGPT. I guess like every article is about ChatGPT right now. ChatGPT, if you don't know, is the open artificial intelligence platform that is natural language. So you can say, hey, ChatGPT, can you explain to me the full synopsis of Moby Dick, and ChatGPT fires it back at you. But it's more than that. It presumes to actually have a fair bit of intelligence. Now, is that really true? Is the code doing anything more than collecting a lot of actual human beings' writings on a subject and synthesizing it into something that is digestible and processable? I don't know. I am not a software engineer. It's an impressive tool. I mean, candidly, it is an impressive tool. I know, for instance, in the marketing world, people are using it to actually write marketing copy. I know that in the research world, people are using it to sort of do digests of research material that it would take them otherwise weeks and months and years, whoever know, to do it themselves. So it's an impressive tool. I personally think that it is just another example of why there need to be more moral philosophers working in Silicon Valley and forming these brilliant people, because the unintended consequences of having very powerful AI platforms that anybody can use is that, like every other tool that has ever been introduced, the minute it's introduced, we decide that it is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and we try to apply it to everything, and then it gets over-applied, and then the consequences of that are often significant and bad and very, very difficult to untangle. So, so it's cool, but, use with caution, and no one gives a shit what I have to say about that, which is why I'm sure Skynet is right around the corner. But this particular article, to get off of ChatGPT for a minute, is actually not what's interesting about it to me is not what was said about ChatGPT. And really, it was this gentleman by the name of Elad Gil, E-L-A-D-G-I-L. He's a Silicon Valley angel investor. He made early bets on Airbnb, Instacart, Square. He's got ties to Google. He's a big deal. And he was talking about ChatGPT, and he was saying that, that ChatGPT is always down because so many users are using it. And he's like, that's actually a good problem to have. Basically, you have a product that has an incredible market fit, and now your concern, if you are the company, if you're OpenAI, the company that produces it, your concern is how do you scale it, right? So, hey, look, I've validated that this has got market acceptance. I've validated the fit within the marketplace. Now I gotta get it to the people, right? So my challenge is now a technical challenge. It's a challenge of scaling. It's a challenge probably of financing. It's a challenge of how many crank turns do you need to make to get this thing scaled and out the door? And his point's exactly right. It is a good problem to have. But he goes on to say something that makes me think about what I want to talk about today, which is risk. And that's that so many people in the startup world, they have almost an entirely opposite problem as ChatGPT, and that is that they have something that doesn't work. They have something that maybe it doesn't work because there's no market fit for it. Maybe it doesn't work because the thing just doesn't frickin' work. But the advice they keep getting from the investment community, from their peers in the startup community, is that, well, just keep grinding. Like, you're just not working hard enough to get yourself out of this issue that your thing has. So it just needs three more tweaks, or it just needs a little more time, or it just needs, you know, maybe this month, if we try the experiment again, it'll work this time. And yeah, he goes on to say, yeah, for every now and then, that is true. Every now and then, something that, it just needs a few more tweaks to get working. But for the most part, when you hit that obstacle, you've not really planned for the thing to actually not work. And so many, you know, the context he's talking about is founders, but I've seen it even in large enterprises. The immediate reaction is, well, just keep working harder. Just bring in more bodies. Just throw more money at it. Just do, it's always, you know, just, first of all, as you know, if you're listening to the podcast for any amount of time, you know, I hate the word just. If someone comes to you and they are beginning a sentence with the phrase, why can't you just, everything after the word just is garbage. They are about to ask you to do something ridiculous and you just need to jump out a window and run. But it's true that is generally the feeling in a lot of organizations. They believe that either the idea is so good or they've put so much into it so far that they can't give up on it. So just put more effort into it. And you know, what this tells me is that people don't really understand risk. They have a really hard time understanding the risk to their project, the risk to their idea, the risk to their enterprise. Sometimes that risk actually does need to be summarized as, there is a risk that this thing doesn't work. There's a risk that people don't want it. There is a risk that we can't do this. But be that as it may, what it tells me is that people, it just reinforces my own belief that people are just very, very bad at assessing risk. And people are bad at assessing risk. I mean, human beings, frankly, are not good at assessing risk. Our brains are not equipped to handle modern risk in any kind of truly meaningful way. I mean, basically, risk is assessed in your brain in two different parts. There's the amygdala, which is the immediate response, right? It processes base emotions that come from sensory inputs. Anger, avoidance, divisiveness, fear, and so on. It's the thing that has evolved to keep you from getting eaten by a tiger, right? That is what the amygdala does. The problem is that human beings evolve much more slowly than the technology that we create. And so the amygdala is basically on all the time, falsely assessing risk to things that perhaps are not as risky, or falsely telling you to do something about that risk that maybe is not appropriate. Now, the other part of your brain that manages risk is something called the neocortex. It is smart. It is intelligent. It's analytic. It can reason. It makes nuanced trade-offs, but it is very, very slow in comparison to the amygdala, which makes an immediate snap judgment, milliseconds, right? So the trick is always to take your time in assessing risk to give the neocortex time to actually evaluate it, to actually figure out just what is going on and what's an appropriate way of handling it. But even then, human brains are still just complicated machines that are annoyingly imprecise, imperfect. Maybe that's why we love ChatGPT so much, is because we think there's a level of perfection and simplicity there. I think that the complexity of the human brain is the thing that allows us to make art and care for one another, but that's a whole other podcast. But even when your brain is behaving, you've got biases. You have, there's an optimism bias. There's a false sense of control that you may have. There's unclear cultural cues. Some people may view risk in one way and others may view it in another way. There's confirmation bias where this happens all the time with executives. They believe a thing, they see something, they decide to incorporate that information that they see into their own confirmation bias. Therefore, the original thing is true. It's almost never the case, but that is a very, very common leadership error. Finally, there's a thing called exposure therapy, where the manner in which you've been exposed to the risk in the past prevents you from adequately assessing it and handling it in the future. If you were walking, this actually happened to me once. I was walking down the street and it's the middle of a beautiful summer day and a bird shit on me. I walked under a tree just as a bird was taking a shit and I got shit on my shirt. And how often do you think that happens? That is such a rare occurrence. But boy, do you think I walk down the street differently now? You bet your ass I do. I avoid trees when I can, when I walk down the street. It's completely absurd. But again, it's exposure therapy. It happened once and therefore it must happen again. Well, it happened once and it was a 1 in 1 millionth shot that was ever going to happen. But you know, I guess if you're struck by lightning once, you think you're going to get struck by lightning again. It's crazy, but it's true. Okay. So the first thing I want you to walk away with is you are bad at assessing risk. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't feel bad about it. You're a human being. That's the way human beings work. There's nothing to be done about how you process risk. However, there is something to be done about how you turn risk assessment and risk management into a process, into something that is declarative, that is controllable, that tries to apply as much objectivity as possible. And so that's why you need a process to assess and manage risk. And that process has got to involve, first of all, other people. It has to involve a wide variety of sources that you can bring in. Maybe it's your core team. Maybe it's additional stakeholders that you've identified. Maybe it's consultants that you bring in. But getting more people to take a look at the exact same risk basically gets you off the hook from having to figure everything out and assess it on your own. So this is an idea here where the wisdom of crowds is actually a true thing, where everyone has biases, but everyone's biases are different. And so if everybody is looking at the same risk, the same assessed risk, then in theory, the collective should be able to accurately process, understand that risk, and then understand what the mitigation strategy or contingency strategy needs to be as a result of it. So you begin by identifying risks with your team. What could go wrong? And then when you analyze these risks, when you try to assess them for things, for, you know, when we talk about risk, we assess it for what? We assess it for the severity of the impact. We assess it for the probability of occurrence. And we assess it for how detectable is this risk? Will we be able to know that this risk is happening to us or this thing is happening to us before we, as the gentleman earlier suggested, add more opportunity cost to another cycle, another iteration, what have you more. Bringing a group of people together to analyze these risks and keeping in mind the following idea. Basically, when you analyze risk from a project standpoint, think about impact first. And when you think about impact, think about how far back does it set your project? A conversation about risk, especially when we talk about a conversation about project risk, it's really how far backwards will we have to go to absorb this risk if it is realized, if it comes to fruition. So let me give you an example. So in some of these companies that the gentleman was talking about, the risk is that the product doesn't work. I'm being general, but bear with me. Risk is the problem. You can't get the product to work. It's just not going to do what your vision says it needs to do. And so an inaccurate assessment and mitigation of that risk means that once you hit that risk, you have to go all the way back to some earlier iterative development cycle to do however many more repetitions you think is necessary to get that thing to work. So mitigating that risk should have been that you have something very early in your development process, and frankly, very cheap in your development process, to validate whether or not this technology, this process, whatever the thing is viable in the first place. So you don't get far down the road in just doing cycle after cycle after cycle, because effectively you have gone backwards. You have spent all this time and money and you're back to square one doing another cycle of development for a thing that doesn't work and it's not going to work. So analysis of risks, if you're doing that with a group of people, their biases could all kind of level each other out. Their experiences can all kind of heighten and inform each other. And you can get to really useful mitigation activities, mitigation and control activities, or potentially developing contingency plans, because you've slowed the process, you've slowed the reactivity down so that your risks are out of your amygdalas and you're into your neocortexes. You're spending time on this. You're absolutely understanding what the true impact of these things are. And you are making it objective. What is an objective measure of impact? It's time and money. How much time, how much money do we have to spend to ameliorate the impact of this risk, right? The product doesn't work. How much time and money are we going to spend in advance of finding that out such that it either cancels whatever we're doing or it forces us to go backwards and re-spend all that money to get to something that does work? Or the product concept has gotten, there's no customer for this product concept. We're solving a problem that doesn't exist. Well, how much time and money are we going to spend before we can answer that question, mitigate that risk? And then is that going to send us backwards, or are we just going to cancel the project at that point? So think about impact in terms of something very, very tangible. And it's going to kind of shift your brain when you think about risk to something that is actually quantifiable and super usable. When you think about the intangible aspects of risk, think about the impact to your stakeholders. Think about that stakeholder plan that we talked about a couple of episodes ago. Pull that out. And what happens when certain things happen during your program that impact negatively your stakeholders? What does that risk represent? And what is the measurable impact? If your project is successful, does it impact your stakeholder such that their job or their position becomes redundant? Are you developing a solution for your enterprise that will cause a reduction in force because those individuals are not needed? Are you developing a solution for your enterprise where you are, say, outsourcing or offshoring jobs that you're currently doing in the United States? It's not to say that those programs are not valid, they're not appropriate. It's to say that understand that your stakeholders each have risk profiles as well. And being a good leader means understanding what those profiles is and either working to ameliorate them as best they can or having contingencies and mitigation activities put into place. In the case of the two things that I just suggested, training. Adding as part of that program, retraining modules to retain talent by giving them different skills that cannot be offshored or outsourced. Alternately, having good offboarding policies, helping people get to their next career with dignity and integrity, as my friend Patty McCord would say. You can listen to her and I talk about this very topic in season two. Having those in place as part of the project plan and accepting that additional cost because it helps you mitigate risk that can be frankly far more expensive down the road. in terms of, again, time and money and intangible things like people's dignity, people's integrity. So understanding you're not good at it, slowing down the process, involve more people, make impact objective, all right? Those are things that project managers truly need to understand to accurately and appropriately assess risk within their projects. Now, why is this a good thing, though? Over and above the obvious, right? You want to understand and mitigate risk so it doesn't take up more time, it doesn't take up more money, and you are successful with your project. That is an obvious thing. But what's less obvious is that project managers who get good at this at the project level, okay, at the specific team level, right, a specific objective level, that set of skills in risk assessment and risk mitigation, that is scalable. That is a scalable set of skills that project leaders can bring with them throughout their career as they take on programs, as they take on portfolios, as they take on functions, as they take on enterprises. If you can understand and get good at assessing and evaluate risks at your project, that is a process that you can hone and you can get better at over time and that will scale with you in your career. And this is the thing I think about, getting back to the layoffs topic of last week, or I guess forever. I gotta wonder if some of these executives never managed projects before, if they don't understand the concept of risk assessment and stakeholder risk. And people want to tell me that layoffs are just part of the business cycle and just the way it is. I continue to refuse to believe that. With the exception of specific disruptions in industries that necessitate a layoff, the pandemic, for instance, force majeures, right, that you can't necessarily plan for. There are very few instances where I would consider layoffs to be sort of an inevitable and appropriate response to a business cycle activity. I think what we're seeing is that Bill George, by the way, former CEO of Medtronic, talked about this. He was like, look, Medtronic was always slow to hire, slow to fire, and never had layoffs. I actually don't know if that's true or not. I probably should have checked that. But I do know, living in Minneapolis for a long time, the number of times you heard about Medtronic having a layoff was quite rare, if ever. I actually can't think of one off the top of my head. But his point was fundamentally that, look, we understand the risk to the business. We understand the risk to the enterprise, and we understand the risk of the industry. And as a result, we are going to move at this pace so that we are not being reactive. That's really what he was saying, right? Slow to hire, slow to fire, never had layoffs. Well, slow to hire and slow to fire, right? You know what I mean? Like you do good onboarding, you make sure that you have the right people. It's all about risk mitigation. And so that's what makes me think that these individuals who are leading large enterprises, I don't believe they have ever had to roll up their sleeves and get their hands and get their arms dirty in a project like you, dear listener, are doing. And therefore, their understanding of this kind of practical understanding of risk is really stunted. And so they are too reactive, right? In when times are good, they're doing stock buybacks and they're hiring a bunch of people and they're popping tops and then celebrating like 1999. And when times, you know, are not as good, not that times are tough. Times are not tough right now. I mean, they're tough for people like myself and my fellow laid off folks, but generally speaking in industry, times are not tough right now. They are quick, too reactive to make adjustments that impact their stakeholders, meaning impact the people that have an interest in the health of the enterprise. So get good at this, guys. Get good at this, everybody. This is really, really important. If you understand risk and you treat it with respect, you treat it appropriately, you turn it into a team event, you use your neocortex, you consider good mitigation and contingency plans, you drive your project in such a way that Even if it's fast and challenging and innovative, you still respect that not everything is always going to go right, and so you can be proactive about it. If you do those things, if you hone these skills, that will scale with you throughout the rest of your career. And frankly, you could find yourself in a situation as leader of an enterprise, and because you've done this work 100 times in the past, you know how to assess risk to your enterprise. You know how to mitigate and form contingency plans that minimize, ameliorate, or even eliminate the negative impacts to your stakeholders, meaning your employees, your customers, and your shareholders. So that's all my time today. Thanks so much for listening. I certainly hope you got something out of this. I really think this stuff is super important. Just as a reminder, the Project Management Masterclass that I am instructing is currently going on. I do a whole module on risk and practical ways of building risk into your project and into your project plan and managing it. You can check that out. You can go to twc.group. That's www.twc.group. Go under courses and you can link right to the Project Management Masterclass. You can check it out to see if something that would be useful for you or your peers or your enterprise to take a look at. All right. Well, look, I am going to let you go. Have a wonderful week. Have an outstanding, risk-free next 7 days, and I will talk with you next Monday.